From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with country music star George Jones. He's been called every country singer's favorite singer. He's written a new autobiography. Also, photographer Roy DeCarava. His pictures of Harlem spanning the last half century and his photos of jazz musicians are featured in a touring retrospective which originated at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And music critic Ken Tucker reviews singer Cassandra Wilson's latest release, New Moon Daughter. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is country music star George Jones. Waylon Jennings once said, if we could all sound like we wanted to, we'd all sound like George Jones. Rock stars like Elvis Costello and Keith Richards have also paid tribute to George Jones. This was his first big hit, She Thinks I Still Care, recorded in 1962.
Just because I ask a friend about her, just because I spoke her name somewhere, just because I rang her number by mistake today, she thinks I still care.
George Jones's musical career has been encapsulated in many reissues. Now he has a new autobiography. He describes the many years he was addicted to alcohol and cocaine, and he gives his perspective on his celebrated but troubled marriage to Tammy Wynette. Jones grew up in rural Texas during the Depression. His father made bootleg whiskey to help make ends meet. George Jones first performed at the age of 9 in Pentecostal churches and revival meetings. After helping to save souls, in his early teens he played to the sinners at rough-and-tumble roadhouses. He was underage, but he worked with a married couple who served as his guardians. Jones says fights often broke out while the band played.
Back in those late 40s, when I was appearing in these places with them, you know, we had to put chicken wire around the bandstand, the little stage we had, to keep bottles from flying over and busting our guitars up. It would be brawls break out every hour or so. But we got through it. It was part of the training, I guess.
Were those bottles intended for the band, or were they just accidentally hitting you?
Not really. There's one or two that get in a fight and start something, and then get knocked into another one, and he'd get mad, and he'd join in fighting them. So next thing you know, it's a dozen fighting, and tables turning over, and bottles are flying, throwing at each other, you know, and they'd naturally head that way, too, you know.
So when there was fighting when you were playing, would you just keep playing?
Well, we were told to do that, and that's what we'd done most of the time, until, you know, it got really too rough to continue, and then we'd quietly bow out and get out of the way.
Let's see, you were married at age 17, divorced a little less than a year later, I think, went into the Marines for a couple of years. How soon did you start recording when you got out of the Marines? And I guess it was 1954.
Right away, in that following February of 54, I went into the studio the first time, and we didn't do all that good until 56, I think, or 55. We lucked up with a tune called Why Baby Why, and then we moved on to Nashville to a larger company that could distribute, you know, records better.
Well, why don't we hear Why Baby Why, recorded in 1955. One of the things interesting about this is that I think really you're best known for your ballads. And this is really up-tempo.
Well, the first days were rough, you know. The early days, we recorded for Starday Records, and really it was terrible sound. We recorded in a small living room of a house on the highway near Beaumont. You could hear the trucks. We had to stop a lot of times because it wasn't soundproof. It was just egg crates nailed on the wall, and the big old semi trucks would go by and make a lot of noise, and then we'd have to start over again.
So George Jones, let's hear your first hit recorded in 1955, Why Baby Why.
Tell me why, baby, why, baby, why you make me cry, baby, cry, baby, cry, baby, cry. I can't help but love you till the day that I die, so tell me why, baby, ah, baby, why. Well, now I've got a crow I want to pick with you, just like last time when the feathers flew. You're running wild, kicking up your heels, leaving me home with a handful of bills. Well, I can't live without you, and you know it's true, but there's no living with you, so what'll I do? I'm going honky-tonk and get as tight as I can, and maybe by then you'll appreciate a good man. Tell me why, baby, why you make me cry, baby, cry, baby, cry, baby, cry.
That's George Jones, his first hit back in 1955. George Jones, how did this record affect your life? How did it change your life?
Well, it gave me a little more to eat and got me to traveling around, driving my car and to places close to East Texas, the big cities, Houston, Dallas, and over into Louisiana, sometimes Oklahoma. And it was a local hit for me. It was a national hit for Red Sevigne and Webb Pierce, which back at that time, Webb Pierce was about the number one big star that was recording at the time.
Now, how did you get the reputation as No Show Jones, of not showing up for dates?
Well, that was easy as time went by. No, I just I missed a few dates back when I was doing a little bit too much of my drinking, and later on I got into drugs But I didn't really miss as many dates as it's been built up to be, but a lot of things the fans and people didn't know that the management that I had around me at the time were also booking dates on me several dates on the same date and getting advanced monies for the dates. And they knew I would get the blame, you know, for it. And that they would never have to refund those monies. So I wound up with so many lawsuits that I didn't know what to do with. So that's why I had all those problems with the lawsuits. And finally got it all straightened out, though, thank goodness. And we don't have to worry about all that anymore.
Right. You went through many years of drinking to excess and then some years of doing cocaine as well. I imagine there was a long period during which, when you performed, you were often very drunk. How did that affect your performance?
Well, I thought it made me do a good job, but I found out later I didn't sound as good as I thought I did. You know, no, but really, to be honest with you, I did drink performing, but I didn't usually go to excess with it. Until after the shows. Usually after the shows is when I stayed up picking in the rooms and stuff like that and partying and running my health and all the other things that came, you know, with it.
Did you have blackouts?
Well, I did a lot of passing out. I don't know about blackouts.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Would you get worried when you'd come back to regain consciousness after passing out and just wonder, what did I do that I've forgotten?
Oh, yeah, many times. You don't realize the things you have done, and then when people start telling you some of the things you've done, you didn't want to hear it, and instead of straightening up then you go right back and do the same things again. So I don't know what makes people do that, but thank God we've found out about it and got a little sense before it was too late.
Actually, it strikes me as being particularly dangerous when you're famous because there's always people out to get you when you're famous. They could make up things that you did while you were drinking and you wouldn't be able to know one way or another whether you did it or not because you'd blacked out.
Well, you know, the things you actually do is bad enough. It's the things that people around right. you, they build it up and make it worse. So that's one reason I wanted to write the book. And there's been a couple of other books out on me that's been written from just hearsay and mountains built out of molehills. And I just wanted to set the record straight. And that's one of the reasons that I went ahead and with Tom Carter and wrote the book. And some of the things they claimed I'd done was even worse when I get through telling it. But so many of the things, though, that I didn't do, that I just like to let everybody know my side of it.
Let's hear another one of your songs. And this is These Days I Barely Get By, which was co-written by you and by Tammy Wynette. And I think you recorded this shortly before or shortly after you separated.
I think so.
Do you remember which it was?
No, but I'm sure it was just before we separated and got divorced.
Tell me what your life was like when you recorded this.
Well, it was already getting to one of the lowest points in my life from drinking so much. And this was what led to a lot to the cause of the divorce. And so you know most of the story after that.
Okay, well, this is These Days I Barely Get By, sung by my guest George Jones.
I woke up this morning aching with pain. Don't think I can work, but I'll try. The car's in the shop, so I thumbed all the way. Oh, these days I barely get by. I walked home from work and it rained all the way. My wife left and didn't say
George Jones, recorded in the mid-70s. I'm wondering, if you're truly living the lyric that you're singing about, do you think that that helps you make it even more expressive?
The song, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I certainly do. I know when I'm singing a song on stage or recording one in the studio, I have to get deeply involved in it and if not, you can't put the emotions and the feelings, and I don't think they come out if you don't.
George Jones is my guest, and he has a new autobiography that's just been published. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with George Jones, and he has a new autobiography called I Lived to Tell It All. Let me play the song that you say turned your life around, and this is He Stopped Loving Her Today. Tell me, before we get to how this song changed your life, what was your life like when you recorded it?
Well, it was getting better. I had came out of rehab, and I was doing a lot better, and I went in and recorded the song that I carried it about a year before while I was all messed up. And it just turned my life around. It was the biggest record that I'd ever recorded in all my recording years. And you know, they say good things happen when you try to do good things, you know. And maybe the good Lord, when I straightened up, it... he was kind of thanking me for it.
Now, you had the song for about a year before recording it, and you asked the songwriter to rewrite it several times. What was the original song like? How is it different from what you recorded, and why did you think it needed to be changed?
Well, when I first got the song and first heard it, it didn't have the last verse of the recitation part. It didn't have that part for the... I kept telling them that the lady had to come back, you know. The girl had to come back one way or the other, either to see him or come to his funeral or something. And they went back and rewrote and wrote the last verse then, that where I do the recitation, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you still sing
this? That was when she came to the funeral, you know.
Do you still sing the song a lot?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, recorded in 1980. This is George Jones, He Stopped Loving Her Today.
He stopped loving her today. It placed a wreath upon his door, and soon they'll carry him away. He stopped loving her today. You know, she came to see him one last time. Oh, and we all wondered if she would. And it kept running through my mind, this time, he's over her for good. He stopped loving her today. It played Stop loving her today.
That's my guest, George Jones. He's written a new autobiography called George Jones, I Lived to Tell It All. How did you finally give up drinking?
Well, first of all, I went in rehab. And I went back during the first couple of years, you know, four or five times, just for a couple of days at a time. You know, when these things would come back on you, you'd get your sickness, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this was about the time that I had met Nancy. And, of course, I was getting all the good help that she could offer.
She's your wife.
And, right. And all of a sudden, one day, you know, it was just over with, you know. And so that's been, I'd say, I'm guessing around 11 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like the first time you sang on stage without drinking?
Well, it was rough. I'll have to say that. It was rough, and after it was rough for about the first couple of 3 weeks. And then each night, you know, I got more used to it, and it was, I was forgetting that I thought I might need it or something like that. And in other words, we fought it and we got through the worst part of it, and then those nights were over.
What's it like to sing drinking songs now? Do they have a different meaning to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's life itself is different. You know, I thought I lived in a science fiction movie or something all them bad years, but... No, it's I wake up and now, you know, and enjoy the farm, enjoy the horses I got, and just have a great time knowing your family and knowing things you never didn't know before, you know, and realizing what you got and what you're thankful for.
Now, have you ever always taken your voice for granted? I mean, here's what I mean. It came so naturally to you. You never seem to have had to work at singing. You just had this gift. And sometimes when people just have something, they don't realize how special it is.
Well, a lot of times you can't see the forest for the trees. We don't wake up when we ought to sometimes, if you know what I mean. And I never did take it all that serious. The only thing I took serious was I love to do it, and the people like to hear it, and that's my happiest times is when I was on stage, and they seemed to be enjoying it. That made me enjoy being there.
Mm-hmm. Did you think of your voice as a gift? I mean, do you think
naturally.
Of it as a gift?
Uh-huh. Naturally, it's. I think there's only a few every now and then that come along that are lucky enough to have the little different sound and in their voice and the drive and the heart, the soul, whatever you want to call it. It's just a little something different that we're blessed with, you know.
It seems to me that for a good part of your career, maybe I'm wrong here, that you didn't much like giving interviews or really, you know, thinking out loud about yourself and your life.
Yeah, I was awful shy when I was growing up, and I didn't like interviews, and I didn't like to be in crowds unless I was on stage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of a loner or shy, whatever you want to say, back in those days. And I just really didn't like giving interviews because I didn't think I could talk, you know, right. And I still think I don't today. I don't know. Just back in those days, I was shy, and I didn't know what to say, you know. I was afraid they would ask me things that I wouldn't know how to answer. So I was really scared more than anything.
And you're comfortable with yourself now?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it.
George Jones, his new autobiography is called I Live to Tell It All. Here's his recording, Bartender Blues. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Now I'm just a bartender, and I don't like my work, but I don't mind the money at all. I see lots of sad faces and lots of bad cases of folks with their backs to the wall. But I need four walls around me to hold my life, to keep me from going astray. And a honky-tonk angel slipping away. I can light up your smokes. I can laugh at your jokes.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, photographer Roy DeCarava. His black and white pictures of jazz musicians and of life in Harlem are published in a retrospective spanning the last half century. And Kentucky Review's Cassandra Wilson's new album, New Moon Daughter.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The work of the great but under-recognized photographer Roy de Carava is collected in a touring retrospective which originated at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. It covers half a century of his photographs of Harlem and of jazz musicians, including Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong, and John Coltrane. De Carava was born in 1919 and grew up in Harlem when it was a center of artistic and literary life. In 1952, he became the first African-American photographer to win a Guggenheim Fellowship. It enabled him to spend a full year taking pictures of daily life in Harlem. In 1955, he collaborated on a book with Langston Hughes called The Sweet Flypaper of Life. De Carava supported himself as a commercial artist and freelance photographer until 1975, when he started teaching at Hunter College, where he's currently a distinguished professor. One of De Carava's Harlem photos from 1952 is called Man Coming Up Subway Stairs. The man looks like he's coming back from a long, hard day of work. He's wearing a rumpled, long-sleeved shirt with the sleeves rolled up and the top button unbuttoned. He's carrying his jacket. He's biting his lower lip as he walks up the stairs. I asked De Carava to tell me about taking the picture.
I was working 9 to 5, and I used to... With like everybody else, I woke up in the morning and went to work and came home, and I was tired. And I was very much aware of my fellow riders and their appearances and their feelings. And I thought, in a sense, that this was a remarkable experience in the sense that these were the people who went to work every day, worked hard, and their lives were rather circumscribed, and in many ways they were borderline in sense in how they lived. And in a way, I thought that their consistency and their perseverance was in itself a rather heroic thing. And there were so many of us that I wanted to find a symbol for that kind of... strength in the subway, as indicated by the appearance of a person after work, and so that this was that picture which I sort of planned. I planned in the sense that I'd seen these kinds of images every day for years, and there was no doubt that I would, when I decided to take a picture, that I would find one that would come along. And so what I did, I established the hours from 4 to 6, so I had to find a place. So I opted for the entrance or the exit of a subway. But it had to be one of those subway stations that have disappeared, but they had a kiosk, which is this overhead covering, and the walls were made of glass, wired glass, and I managed to find one, believe it or not, with a hole in it so that I could stand on the side and wait for this gentleman or person or woman to come up the stairs. And he eventually did, and he was perfect.
What made him perfect?
Well, he had all of the things that one associates with being tired and yet constant. I mean, he was determined. I mean, he was determined to get home, or maybe he was just determined to get up at the top of the stairs because he was very tired. And I sensed that when I saw him through the corner of my eye down at the bottom of the stairs. And to prove it, when he got to the landing, he rested, which gave me a chance to put another roll of film into the camera, because at that time I only had one exposure left, and I was debating whether I should wait until he got there or put in another roll. So when he stopped to rest on the landing, I was able to put another roll of film in. And so when he got there, I had plenty of film to case I needed to take more than one. But fortunately, I only needed that one anyway.
Now, did you ever find out who this man was, and did he ever find out that you took a now celebrated photograph of him?
No, I don't think so. People generally, I don't know. I'd have no idea. This was taken a long time ago, and I've never had any anybody say anything to me about it, so I imagine not.
I'd like to ask you about the photograph that's on the cover of your Museum of Modern Art catalog.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a picture of a woman walking down the steps, taken, I believe, in the early 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And the photograph ends at about her, just right above her waist. Mm-hmm. So basically you see her coat, you know, the bottom half of her coat. You see one mm-hmm. arm, you see two legs sticking out from under this long coat. We have no idea who she is or anything about her. But in a way, it reminds me of the kind of image I see a lot, like if I'm looking down or if I'm looking up, but I'm not looking up far enough
mm-hmm.
to see a person's whole body. Tell me why you framed it this way. Why were you just seeing the bottom half of her body?
Well, because the body talks to you. The body says things to you. You don't have to see a face to know. You can see a body. A person's way they carry themselves. Every individual is unique in that sense and in every sense. So that there's, I guess, for want of a better phrase, it's body language. The body tells you, your feet, your legs, how you walk, how you stand, how you relax. They tell you things. And they can, you know, if you look and have the patience to relax and have an empathy with something other than yourself, and yourself, because you, in a way you're mirroring yourself. You're seeing how you feel. And I thought that this was a very beautiful moment. It was a very delicate kind of image of a woman, definitely a woman, and it was beautiful. I liked it.
One of my favorite of your series of photos of jazz musicians is a backstage photo. It's during a session break with the Ellington Orchestra, mm-hmm. taken in 1954.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's such a beautiful composition of repose and disarray.
Right.
Because it's backstage, you know, in the center of the photograph is a coat rack. On either side of the coat rack is a jazz musician. They're each facing in opposite directions. They're each facing the wall. They're sitting on folding chairs, each reading something. I can't tell whether it's, you know, sheet music or the newspaper. And there's, you know, folding chairs kind of scattered around and a lot of overhead lights.
Right, right.
But it's such a...
You have good eyes.
Oh, thanks. It's such a kind of quiet moment. And
Yeah, I understand. I feel the same way about it. You know, one of the things that is important to me is that one doesn't have to be so literal and so narrow in one perception of music. Music is a very broad category, if you will, and the musicians to me are very important. So it really is not so much about their playing. Singularly, you know, photographing, playing something, but it's about my interest in them as people and how they
mm-hmm.
how they respond to what they do and what they do, you know, like when they relax or when they go somewhere. You know, the idea that musicians are entertainers and then after they're entertaining, they disappear. They don't disappear. They go home. They go to their families or their friends and they eat like we do. So I'm interested in all of that. And their resting is certainly one that is very important to me and very beautiful, you know. It's not just the act itself. It's a kind of a perception of them in their total environment as much as possible,
mm-hmm.
you know.
One of the things I really love about your photographs is the lighting. Many of your photographs, I venture to say most of the photographs of yours that I've seen are really pretty dark with very subtle shades of, you know, grays and blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clearly a work of art. It's not reality. This looks different mm-hmm. than reality because
right,
of the lighting.
Right.
And I'm wondering what inspired you to go for that very dark atmospheric lighting that almost reminds me of certain film noir.
Uh-huh. Well, it's first of all, I have to confess that it's what I like. I love the tonal scale, the photographic scale, which means simply the range of tone from black to white. It's so unique. There's no other process that can give you this this kind of tonality. And I'm in love with that. And I find the best way to get to deal with that is to not think of it in terms of black and white in a graphic sense, you know, the way a woodblock is or an engraving, but as a tonal scale that we're dealing with. And I love to see that. And in addition to which, when I photograph, I accept the lighting conditions, whatever they are. And I try not to say, well, you can't photograph that because it's too dark or there's not enough light. I don't believe in that. I believe if I can see it, I can photograph it. And I accept the outcome in the sense that it is black and white, and that in itself removes it from reality. And a lot of the things that I do, for instance, are in the subway, and the subway is not exactly daylight, and people, even in people's homes, in terms of the technology, the film is sensitive, but it, in order to really show it, you have to really print it what I call full. And that tends to be on the dark side. Let's say if, you know, 50% is this and 50%, it tends to be more on the dark side of 50. And that doesn't bother me at all. In fact, it gives it a luminosity that you can't get by printing normally. And what we consider normal is the information. In other words, one of the things that one gets in a photograph is information. And I would rather sacrifice the information in terms of details and things like that mm-hmm. for a feeling of mood.
Yeah, yeah. Did you resist color when
yes.
color came
about? Well, I didn't resist it. It just didn't attract to me. I wasn't never attracted to it because I didn't... at first, I didn't like the garishness of it. The color, when it was first introduced, was very garish.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not like that. And even when it's been, you know, now it's pretty... You can get all kinds of tonalities with color now. In fact, it's gotten to the point where every manufacturer has a different idea of what color is, in a sense that they manufacture their film according to a color standard, which is rather arbitrary, because you'll have 10 different manufacturers, and their color scale will vary. So it doesn't lend itself to the kind of control that I care about.
Mm-hmm.
But the main reason I don't use it is because it particularizes too much. It's very difficult to do a color photograph without thinking about color first and
right.
not what the photograph is about, because color tends to be arbitrary, especially when you're dealing with human beings who dress up brightly when they're feeling sad, and when they're feeling bright, they may have on a black suit.
My guest is photographer Roy DeCarava. His touring retrospective opens in Chicago June 8th. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Roy DeCarava, a traveling retrospective spanning nearly a half century of his work includes his photographs of daily life in Harlem. Now, what was Harlem like when you were a child?
Oh, it was very different than it was now. It was more relaxed. It had a kind of stability to it in terms of people living there. I remember that there were two avenues. There was 7th Avenue and Lenox Avenue, and those were the two main thoroughfares. And 7th Avenue was really the avenue which had the most affluent people and tenants living on 7th Avenue. Yet Lenox Avenue was the busiest one. Both of those avenues were very wide and very exciting and filled with people and... It was different. Now it's almost like I go up there now and I'm appalled. It's like a bombed out area in some senses because of the houses that are vacant and broken down, and you know, I mean, it's an incredible change from what I knew.
Now, I know your mother moved to New York from Jamaica when I believe she was 17.
Right.
And she raised you as a single mother. Was she very determined that you would succeed? Did she push you?
No, she protected me, which is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
She cared about me, and she was very, she was really very concerned about me and very attached and caring. And she wanted me to do things. I mean, she loved music, so she wanted me to be a musician. And she loved the violin, so she wanted me to play the violin. But I remember the turning point in our relationship, I think, her perception of me, was when that a teacher from the public school system came to my house and told my mother that I was very gifted and that she should encourage me, because the teacher was very encouraging. She had bought me a paint set, and I was very much concerned with my future. And she took the time to come to my house and talk to my mother about me. And I thought that was I look back now, and I can hardly see that happening nowadays. But it was a beautiful thing, I think, on the part of the teacher. And my mother took her seriously, and from then on she encouraged me to do and be what I wanted to be, you know, which was to draw and to pursue that avenue.
Now, in one of the catalog essays for the catalog of your photography show, it explains that you were drafted in 1942 and that you had a terrible experience. 43, okay.
Yeah.
But it says you had a really bad experience in the military and that you were in a psychiatric ward for about a month and ended up with a medical discharge. What happened? Did you have a nervous breakdown?
I guess you'd call it that, yeah. And it was the conditions of, I hate to even think about it. Just very uncomfortable and very mean and destructive, not only to me, but to so many black soldiers. Because at that time, there were two armies, you know. One was black and one was white. And the only reason for the separation is to treat black people different from white people. And that's what happened in the army. And in the army, there is no such thing as democracy. And you had to do what you were told, and they tried to break you down and make you a soldier, you know, which was something that went against what I was. So I had a difficult time, but I'm glad to be out of it, and I no longer have nightmares.
How did being a soldier go against who you were?
Well, because there was no... Well, because it was... You had to do things. You were forced to do things that you had really no interest in. And I didn't like the idea of killing people. I didn't like the idea of being killed. I didn't like the whole destructive thing that the army is made for. It's made, you can define it as protection. You can define it as this and that and the other. But the end result is about killing and not be killed. And that was too, that to me is not a very civilized position to be in.
So what was your month in the psychiatric ward like?
Well, it was where I learned about democracy.
What do you mean?
I mean, it was the only place in the whole United States Army where we weren't segregated. So we weren't really the crazy ones. It was the people outside who were crazy.
That's interesting. So did it change your sense of yourself when you got out of the Army? Did you see yourself differently than you did before you got in?
Yeah, I valued myself more.
That's interesting, because you think that kind of experience would kind of break you down and that you'd lose self-esteem.
Well, if I stayed in there long enough, I probably would have. And that's what I was fighting against.
So tell me about coming out and feeling like you valued yourself more.
Well, I just looked at the sky and I looked at the ground and I said, hallelujah. I was free to go and do as I please and to pursue my life in a way that was constructive, you know. I didn't have to learn how to shoot and how to do this and do that. And I felt that I could live. No one told me when to get up. No one was overtly cruel to me and mean and authoritarian. And no, it was wonderful to be free, to get up in the morning and be responsible for yourself.
What kind of subject matter would you say interests you most now in your photography?
I think what it's about is my feelings. I mean, I've come to the conclusion that it's what I look at and it's how I feel about things that really is what I'm dealing with, not so much the subject as how I feel about the subject. And the subject can be anything, depending how I feel at that moment. So that really it's about my perceptions that I'm really trying to express. And my perceptions are the same perceptions that other human beings feel. So therefore, I have a kinship with that.
Well, Roy DeCarava, I want to thank you very much. And congratulations on your show.
Thank you. And I hope that you liked it, and I hope that people liked it. And I was glad that I was invited to talk about it. Thank you.
Photographer Roy DeCarava. His retrospective opens at the Art Institute of Chicago June 8th, then travels to Los Angeles, Andover, Massachusetts, St. Louis, Houston, San Francisco, Atlanta, and Washington, D.C. This is Fresh Air. Over the past decade, Cassandra Wilson has moved from being considered a jazz vocalist to an unclassifiable singer. Her latest release, New Moon Daughter, is her most eclectic collection yet, featuring interpretations of songs made famous by everyone from Billie Holiday to the Monkees. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. Here's Wilson's version of Hank Williams' country music classic, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry.
Hear that lonesome whippoorwill. He sounds too blue to fly. Midnight train is whining low. I'm so lonesome I could cry.
On New Moon Daughter, Cassandra Wilson creates an atmosphere of lush romanticism and moody reverie. Whether she's contemplating with simmering sorrow the lynching described in the Billie Holiday hit Strange Fruit, or finding fresh implications in Hoagy Carmichael's Skylark, Wilson's tone is always measured and resolute. She sings about tumultuous emotions with great control. She brings enormous force and strength, for example, to her version of the Sun House blues song, Death Letter.
I got a little this morning. How do you reckon it be? Hurrying man, you love is dead. I got there this morning. How do you reckon it read? Let me see you hurry, hurry. Only got the man you love is dead. Well, I grabbed up my suitcase, took out down. When I got there, he was laying
on the cooling board. Grabbed up my suitcase and I took out down the road. And I got there in the lane, playing on the cooling board.
As a pop music critic, I was, of course, most curious to learn that jazz singer Wilson had decided to interpret the Monkees' Last Train to Clarksville on this album. The very idea seemed at once foolish and bold. After all, even when you get past the memory of the Monkees' jangly, twangy folk rock original, the authors of this piece, songwriters Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, have written some darn catchy tunes but have never been known for their piercing lyrical insights. So this was the performance where, as far as I was concerned, Cassandra Wilson proved she's really got the goods. She manages to make Clarksville sound like a destination worth yearning for.
Take the last train to Clarksville, and I'll meet you at the station. You can be here by 4:30, cause I made a reservation. Don't be slow. No. Have one more night together till the morning brings my train. I must go. Oh, no, no, no. Oh, no, no, no. And I don't know if I'm ever coming home.
Until now, my primary criticism of Cassandra Wilson was that her insistence upon subtle restraint sometimes disguised or buried the emotions that drew her to a particular song in the first place. That's not true anywhere on New Moon Daughter, however. Here, Wilson's smoky tone and firm enunciation serve the music, lending it a power that's all the more effective for being so beautifully simple and direct.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Cassandra Wilson's new album, New Moon Daughter. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Roberta Sherrock, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Skylark, have you anything to say to me? Can you tell me where my love might be? Is there a meadow in the mist where someone's waiting?
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dow Jones Business News and Information Services, featuring Dow Vision, a direct-to-desktop customized news service. This is NPR, National Public Radio.